Hi everyone, welcome to Arnie Monkey. My name is Adam Barrow. What do Formula One motor racing and cloud hoppers have in common? The answer is today's guest. Steve Roke spent almost 30 years working for one of the most successful motor racing teams in the world, McLaren Racing. While there, he continued to build his passion for aviation, became a balloon pilot, and fulfilled a long-held ambition to get his own hopper. He's also recently organised a world record attempt and published the 100th edition of the Cloud Hopper newsletter, which he edits. In this interview, we'll talk to Steve about all of those passions, beginning with his love of aviation, moving through into his racing career, and then on to ballooning. Welcome to Arnie Monkey, Steve.
Hello there. Nice to be here.
And where do we find you at the moment, Steve?
You find me sat at home on a bright October morning about 30 miles south of London in a little village called Frimley, which is near where they host the Farnborough International Airshow. I'm about 3 miles from the Farnborough International Airshow Airport.
It's a nice spot.
Yeah, it's lovely.
So what was your first love, Steve? Obviously, you've got this big background with the motor racing, and you've also got a background with aviation. What was your first love? Was it cars or was it aviation?
No, my background is I've always had a passion for aviation. As a kid, I was the guy who used to go up to the International Airport at Heathrow. I'd stand on the top of the Queen's building, which was a visitor centre, and I'd watch the planes come and go every day. And I just had a passion where I thought, you know what, I've got to get involved with these things in some shape, form or manner. I joined my local Air Cadets, which is an offshoot of the RAF, the youngsters who want to get involved. That got me flying. I did a bit of glider flying. I did a bit of air experience flying in old RAF training aeroplanes called Bulldogs and Chipmunks. And eventually it got me into a career initially that started me in aviation working for the National Aerospace Company, British Aerospace, where I had an apprenticeship and I ended up being a factory worker building such things as BAC 111 wings and Tornado fighter jet tailplanes.
Of course you were. That's the obvious transition for everybody, right? So standing on the end of the runway to building Tornadoes, it just makes sense. So with that, when you were sort of getting a glider flying and all that sort of stuff, how old were you then? What sort of age is that in with the cadets?
I started at about 13. I was very fortunate. I had an American uncle who was in the US Air Force based over here in the UK, and he was based at a place called Upper Heyford on what was F-111 swing wing fighter bombers. And he was a glider pilot himself. So the family connection and the thing that I was in the Air Cadets just got me interested and it gave me more opportunities. I was the kind of kid who went every weekend to my local RAF station where they had a glider and you'd take your turn moving these things around on the airfield. And eventually you'd get your chance to be in the front seat with a qualified pilot behind you, giving you your air experience flights.
So it runs in the family for you then, aviation. It's in your blood.
I guess so, yes. I wasn't aware at the time that my American uncle, who was over here, was that passionate about aviation. But yes, I guess so. We've always been a family that's been interested in engineering. Aviation came first for me. But I also had an uncle who was a very prominent model engineer in steam locomotives. So the kind of things that were about a foot and a half, 2 foot long, 3.5, 5 inch gauge, he used to make them, manufacture them. He'd go to university colleges of an evening and he'd do his CNC engineering and, you know, he'd build these things. And he was the guy who took me to these events. And he was the guy who took me from airfield to airfield, furthering my passion for aviation.
That's awesome. That is such a great connection to have that with the family. That's just fantastic. I'm a little jealous.
Yeah, it's lovely. He also introduced me to beer.
Well, it sounds like he's a well-rounded uncle then.
He was a great fella. Yeah, very nice. My connection with my uncle was strong because my father was in the Royal Navy, and believe it or not, he was also connected with aviation. He had 23 years on aircraft carriers. So for a lot of the time, my father was away, but my uncle stepped into the breach and nurtured my enthusiasm.
So what sort of role did your dad have in the Navy on the aircraft carriers?
He was a radio technician. He was radio radar, so he was comms man, and he was on most of the traditional English carriers of the 60s and 70s and 80s. He did 23 years on it. So we're talking about the time when the aircraft on board would be things like Fairey Gannets or Buccaneer Strike planes or Scimitars or Sea Vixens, really old stuff.
Yeah. Did he see any action while he was in the Navy? Did he end up like in the Falklands or anything like that?
No. Not around like that vintage? He was the kind of guy who had a 9-month tour to the Far East.
Right. Nice. So you're there working for BAE in that role. How long are you with them and working there?
I was there for 8 years. I was an apprentice. I was a craft at the factory, which means I was a hands-on technician. I was a guy who learned to be an airframe fitter, but I was technician at college. So I was kind of split role. I did my HNC, HND, and my degree course at the local technical college on day release. In some cases, it took me 2 days a week because my maths was lousy and calculus was a subject that was just foreign to me.
I was lucky. I never got forced to do calculus. So that's something I've got a great deal of thanks for my parents.
Quadratic equations and function of a function and phasers. I thought a phaser was something Captain Kirk used on the Enterprise.
And so so you stayed there at BAE, and did you see yourself with that career in aviation, like as you look forward, that was the career you thought you'd have?
No, I was a troubled soul because I was in a factory with no windows. You'd go in first thing in the morning in pitch darkness, you'd come out at darkness, you were a cog in a wheel, you were a name and a number. I was a departmental number followed by a four-figure number for myself. And I saw myself going nowhere quick in an environment where the industry was in entrenchment. It was actually closing down. The figures where I were, the factory 5 years prior to me getting there had 20,000 souls.
Wow.
And when I left in 1984, they were down to about 10,000.
Wow. That's amazing. I didn't realize you had that vast experience in the aviation, particularly in that sort of airframe and fitting environment. Well, how did you end up with McLaren, I guess, is the big question. You know, Formula One for most of us mere mortals, and I'm a passionate motor racing fan, it's like we look at the world of Formula One, there's so much money, it seems so exclusive, and it, like the thought of even trying to break into that just seems so foreign to me. How did it end up sort of landing with you?
I was very fortunate. I had some very good friends. At the time, in the 80s, we were actually into rallying. Rallying was our big thing. I had a passion for Audi Quattros. I eventually bought one after 10 years of saving my money for it. You know, Group B rallying at the time was the big thing. It was the Hannu Mikkelas, the Stig Blomqvists, the Walter Rolls of this world, Michel Mouton. You know, these were the beasts that I was into. But through those group of friends who I'd done my apprenticeship with and I socialised with, I got the nod that there was a new Formula One team starting locally that couldn't get people with composite experience, but they were willing to take aerospace-trained people and teach them this new, you know, fantastic medium of composites. And would I be interested in going ahead and having a go? And I just thought, it was my meal ticket out of aviation and into something where I could be more than a cog in a wheel and a useful part in a smaller organisation.
And when are we talking here, Steve? Put us in time here. What sort of year is this?
We're talking March 1984, and the team concerned was called Formula One Race Car Engineering, or otherwise known as Beatrice Lola, which was an outfit that started up an offshoot of two of the founder members of McLaren International, a guy called Teddy Mayer and a guy called Tyler Alexander, who was a lovely fella. And they'd got big money from Beatrice, which was an American-sponsored company. They had a lot of brands under them. They were the 33rd biggest company in the States. And they employed ex-world champion Alan Jones and Patrick Tombay. So they made a real statement from the word go.
Yeah, they just came in and went, bang, we've got these fantastic drivers. We're being serious about this. Let's just get in and make it happen.
Well, we thought it was the future. We thought we had a works engine deal with Ford. Alan Jones was well established. Our first season, we had good results, nothing spectacular, but the car was okay. We thought we were going places up until the point in 1985 when Beatrice had a change of their CEO and the new guy just didn't like motor racing. So they decided to get out. And although Alan Jones had an option to buy the team with Foster's money behind him, it never happened.
It's a shame. And, you know, Alan Jones is very, you know, has got a place in our hearts in Australia, of course. So it would have been fantastic to see him in there.
Yeah, it was almost like it was going to be a national team for Australia. And so I was made redundant on Monday. I'm not somebody who sits around on my backside doing nothing. So Monday afternoon, I'd gone into a job agency. I got myself a job back at British Aerospace at Weybridge, where I worked, chasing aircraft on the ground spares. I did that for 5 weeks. I shouldered all of those comments that you get off people. Oh, I'll see you back. You're never going to work at that. And then 5 weeks later, I joined another motor racing team called Arrows, which was up in Milton Keynes with the fledgling designer, Ross Braun, who wasn't very well known at that time.
Yeah, unlike now where he's a superstar of the sport.
Well, yeah. So at the time, the Arrows team was owned by a guy called Jackie Oliver. It had two drivers in Eddie Cheever, an American guy, and a guy from Britain called Derek Warwick. And we had a BMW engine that was called a Megatron, and it's fantastic. It was supposed to be an engine that ran on 5 bar, but the regulations at the time for turbo pressure was it had a 2.5 bar pop-off valve, so you never got the most out of the engine, and we were perennial fourth or fifth in every race that we entered.
And so what were the type of components that you were manufacturing?
Well, from the word go, we were doing wings, floors, chassis, seats for the drivers. About 70% of the car at that time was carbon fibre.
And what would you say when you finished up with them, what percentage of the car? Is it still around that or has it increased?
Well, at that time, we're talking mid-80s, so Beatrice Lola was 84, 85. I went to Arrows for 86 to 87. I left Arrows in 87 because I was living away from home in Diggs and I didn't like the commute. It was 70 miles. So I came down and joined a local team called Team Tyrrell, which was Ken Tyrrell, who was quite well known in those days. I did a year for them, but all the time I was doing this, you never knew whether or not you were going to get paid at the end of the week or the end of the month because, you know, these teams are fledgling teams, with the exception of Tyrrell. And money was tight. So a friend of mine said, look, you know, why don't you join McLaren? Because if you're going to be in Formula One, you might as well be in a team that's going to stick around.
Fair
and,
call.
You know, I knew of the pedigree of McLaren and I knew of the history. I actually originally resisted going there because I thought, why would I want to go to a team that's won everything, you know? And when I joined them on the 2nd of January 1989, Ayrton Senna and Alan Prost had just won 15 of the previous 16 races the year before to set a record.
Was it 28 years, I think it was, you were there for, Steve? Was it 27 or 28?
I did 26 and a half with McLaren before I branched out to do my own thing. I now work as a contractor and I work for various people. and I'm just sitting here waiting to be told of a contract for winter build for 2017-2018 with Williams.
Nice.
So I'm going to work for another Formula One team up in Grove in Oxfordshire, which is about 50 miles commute from where I live.
Well, look, keep us all in mind down here for tickets. You know, VIP's fine. We can live with that. It's okay.
Yeah, I hear you.
So what about the ballooning side? Like, how did you get tangled up in the sport of ballooning?
Probably the way most people do. As I said, I used to go plane spotting. I'd go to these air shows. I'd go to airports. That took me along to a balloon festival, and I saw all these, you know, ripstop fabric things going up in the air, and I thought it was amazing. My first experience of coming across a hopper, I went to a little Easter balloon festival in the Cotswolds, which is west of London, about 40 miles. We're talking a nice valley. The event was surrounding a pub, so it was very sociable. They had a couple of fields there. About 100 balloons took off. And one of the last ones out was a cloud hopper. And I thought, God, this is an amazing piece of engineering. I really like this thing of less is more. I hadn't at that stage got involved. But, you know, when you're a fan of engineering, it doesn't matter what it is, you can appreciate it. And I then met my wife and, you know, as my girlfriend, I took her for a balloon flight for her birthday. And it was with a Kiwi guy through a company called Flying Pictures, who were wildly quite well known.
And, very well known, yes.
And it sowed a seed with me. We then went to a few festivals where we'd book a nice hotel. We'd go for a weekend away. You'd see the balloons in the morning, the balloons at night, and you'd go and do something nice during the day, which invariably involved a pub for a nice lunch. In various parts of the country, which were lovely. I did this about 10 or 15 times, and then I just said to the wife, I honestly feel I'm the wrong side of the fence. I need to be more involved. So I went to a local event, and I said to this chap, how do you get more involved? And he said, well, where do you live? I told him, and he said, well, what you do is you join your local club. So I went along in my Audi Quattro that I'd finally got hold of after all those years of saving, and being close
with all the rally lights, Steve was still on it. You had extra handbrakes, everything still set up for rallying, I'm assuming, in the car.
I was kind of getting to the end of it because my experience with the Audi was it wasn't galvanized, so it cost me 18,000 UK pounds when I bought it for a 1990 car that had done about 80,000 miles, and I luckily sold it for 18,000 pounds some 9 years later. But it cost me £9,000 to keep it nice because if it rusted, if you saw a blemish on the bonnet, it'd come from the inside out.
Yeah.
So you had no choice but to change the bonnet. So anyway, I went along to this balloon club. I was kind of getting to the end of this fed up of paying out for this damn car. And I met this chap. I said, look, I'm new here. I don't know what I'm doing. He said, my name's Lawrence. I'm going to go fly my Viva 77 with my wife and my two kids. He said, if you're happy to help my wife construct the balloon and then follow in my car, we'll put it away wherever we end up and we'll go to a pub and we'll have a drink. Does that sound okay? I said, you know, do I not like a drink in a pub? Of course it's okay. So we went and did this. We got to the end of the evening. He said to me, well, how was that for you? I said, it was brilliant. I've seen parts of the countryside I'd never see. I've been to places that I never knew existed. You know, thatched cottages down little leafy country lanes in the UK are very picturesque. I just thought it was a whole different side of life to what I was used to. And he said to me, well, if you're interested, he said, I'll take your phone number. The next time we go, I'll give you a call. So I did this three or four times with him. And on the fifth time, he said to me, well, today you're in the basket, so you get to fly.
And when's this, Steve?
So that's how
what sort of year are we talking about here?
I would say that is 97, 98, something like that.
And so from the first time you saw the balloon, when you're out in the countryside and you saw these 100 balloons take off,
yep,
to this event, how long was that, do you think, that you'd been going along? And
83, I went to this very first event,
83.
So
15 years.
15 years of getting sort of to the point where I thought I've got to, because I got fed up with rallying. Rallying had had sort of done its thing. Group B was finished because of the terrible crowd control and the terrible accidents, and rallying became rally cross, which is rallying in a closed circuit with mixed conditions. But even that had become staid, and you know, the times of a twin turbo 911 Porsche with 900 horsepower and four-wheel drive were over. So, you know, the beasts that these people were driving and controlling had come to the end of their natural life, and I needed something new to project myself into. So ballooning became the thing, and I started crewing for this Lawrence, and I joined this club, and that got me involved with other people. And so the cycle goes, and you go to different events. And eventually, when I got to the point where I thought, I really like this, but I want my own destiny, when I bought my first balloon and sold my Audi Quattro, Lawrence, bless his cotton socks, was the guy who started teaching me to fly. So we went full circle in that environment.
So was your intention always to fly a cloudhopper, or did you just like the idea of ballooning generally?
Well, I'm a guy, people won't know this, but I'm a guy who likes minimalism. I have this sort of sick interest in things that are part to the bone. So I ride motorcycles. I like touring on motorcycles. So if you take a motorcycle with hard luggage on it, you've got to go minimalistically with the stuff you take, your tent and your sleeping bag, your cooking stuff and your clothing. You pare it down to a bone. I also still have a grudging admiration for things like smart cars, because they do a job in an environment where you think less is more. And the whole thing with hoppers compared to a regular balloon, it's less is more. It's like, again, back in my early days of Formula One, I was into windsurfing and I was into using laser dinghies. And if anyone has used those kind of things, you know that you extract the most from the wind using minimalistic equipment, and you know, you have an appreciation of the engineering behind the stuff you're using, and you just get the most out of it. And I thought, to me, the cloudhopper was going to be the sports car of ballooning, because you'd have to fly it differently and you'd have to put more inputs in, and you know, being a small capacity, it was never going to stay flying straight and level. It was either going to go up or it was going to come down, so you had to be on it and controlling it in a separate way to the normal balloon, which, you know, you'd put a burn in and then you'd wait 90 seconds before you put the next one in.
So I was going to ask you a question which you sort of answered in a way there, because one of the questions was, what was the attraction of the cloud hopping, which you've said is that minimalism, I should say. But for me, I wasn't sure if it was like also some of the adventure, or whether it was also that freedom of not having that basket around you. There were two options. Or the third option was, I thought maybe you just didn't have any friends who could go flying with you.
Well, no. The funny thing is, once you've got a balloon, it's a catalyst for a good time with your friends. I've got a lot of people who like to come ballooning with me. I still have regular balloons. I mean, my current sum, I have the ability to use five, of which only two of them are hoppers. But I would say, answering your question, if you've ever ridden a motorbike, then you know it's a seat-of-the-pants experience. When you go around a corner, you lean into the corner, you get the most out of it. When you use a windsurfer, you're leaning against the sail and you're trying to get the maximum speed out of the potential against, you know, the prevailing wind. When you get into a cloudhopper, like with my gliding experience, some of my early gliding experiences were in open cockpit gliders. Wow. So you weren't protected from the forces. And, you know, you get this sensory perception of the feel of the thing. When you're in a cloud hopper, it's a seat-of-the-pants experience, and you're exposed rather than cocooned like you are in a basket. So you feel everything. I think it's more rewarding because you've got all your sensory perception is heightened.
I agree, 100%. So you, 1983, you see your first hopper, and if my research is right, You got your pilot's license in 2003, so 20 years from seeing the first balloon.
That's right, it was, because I spent a lot of time crewing for people and I wanted to get grounded in my flying. You know, I wanted to understand the engineering behind ballooning before I got involved. And I'll tell you a very quick story. Lindstrand Hot Air Balloons at the time were based in North Wales. I knew the sales director there, a guy by the name of Mike Webb.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for 3 years, I'd go along to these balloon festivals and he'd go, and, you know, he'd say, "Hello, Steve, how are you doing? How's the family? You know, how's your sport going? Is there anything we can do for you?" And I'd say, "Well, you know, I'm interested. I quite like double jet stream burners. I like the engineering behind them. I like the finish of them. You know, the metal finish was always fantastic. You know, if I can understand the engineering, then maybe I can be enthusiastic about doing it myself." So I spoke to them. I never bought one for about 3 years, but every single time I spoke to them, to me, it was, you know, it was class engineering. It may not have been the cheapest. It may not have been the most expensive. It was kind of the Volvo car of ballooning because it was solid, dependable, reliable, and you knew it wouldn't let you down. And so my ethos was, if I was going to go into ballooning, I'd buy my first balloon, which was a Lindstrand 90 with a double jet stream burner. And, you know, I'd be looking at something that would last me 20 years, not 20 minutes, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. But let's forget about those fat normal balloons. No one's interested in that stuff. Everyone's got one of those, mate. Let's forget about those things.
Yeah.
So you've got 20 years waiting for this dream to come to reality. A couple years after that, you've done some time. Yeah, sadly. So in two years later, you get the chance to go for your first hopper flight ever. You know, that's, you've got 22, 23 years, whatever it is, of waiting for this experience, fulfilling your ambition. That must have been something really special and really memorable.
Oh, I tell you, it was scary. I nearly killed myself on the first flight. I got my license in, no, this is not widely known, but I'll tell you. I got my license in 2003 and I flew regularly.
It's just you and I, Steve. Steve, it's just you and I. No one else is listening to this podcast. It's fine.
But I'll tell you, Adam, seeing as it's you. I started, the first thing about cloud hopping was I could see that at the end of every year, there was this event called the one-man meet where all the commercial pilots got together with their commercially sponsored hoppers and they'd go for a big weekend away and have a good yahoo in October and, you know, they'd have a few drinks and they'd do a few flights in these cloud hoppers. So as a hopper fan, I thought it was brilliant, but I thought it was a bit of an exclusive club, which not many people knew about. There wasn't much projection about hopping at the time. So I looked up on the web and I found a site called cloudhopper.org run by an American guy called John Ninamia. And he'd done this website about his activities in the States. And I just thought, there's nothing in Europe for this. There's nothing our side of the pond that really shows off this small percentage of the ballooning world. So I set up this Yahoo group in January 2004, which was just an email connected group on Yahoo. And the first guy who asked, could he be a member of my group, was a guy by the name of Don Pickard.
Don Pickard.
I mean, this is the godfather of cloud hopping. This is a guy who in the 60s sat on a tank and rode its side saddle when, you know, everyone thought they were mad. And this guy's asking me, could he be a member of my group? So of course he was invited in. And that was the start of it. And I just started doing a quarterly magazine that I thought, well, if there's anything to tell people about it, maybe I could write this newsletter, you know, in a sort of crap English way, because I've got no journalism background or anything like that. But I thought the more that people know about them, the more they might appreciate them. So I started this in 2004. I didn't actually get my first flight in a hopper till 2005.
So 2004 is interesting because that's around the same time that Auntie Monkey was also hitting the scene. And there was that, like, it seemed like at the time there was this real want from people to connect. And obviously that's where social media's come out of that need as well. But so it's interesting that you were setting that up at the same time that we were sort of getting Auntie Monkey up and going as well.
Well, I think it's just surprising, yes. I just think it was an extension of my passion towards something that If I couldn't get involved in it at that time, because I might not have had the wherewithal, I could express my passion in another way. So I thought, if I vent myself by writing these newsletters and having this email forum group, you know, maybe it was a way of satisfying myself till I got to the point where I could buy my own.
Mm. So now, how did you nearly kill yourself? I've been hanging for this story.
Yeah, this is a nice one. I went to a winter balloon festival in the Alps in Austria in a place called Montendorf. And it was run by a German guy called Marcus Hagenay. And the balloon event was called Ice and Fire. And it was in a small valley surrounded by mountains on three sides. And this chap had an old Thunder and Colt chariot with a 31 envelope. And I'd expressed an interest in having a go in it. And he said, well, you know, if you want to have a go, mate, it's just there in the corner. Why don't you take it out on the airfield tomorrow and just, you know, see how it goes? So the following morning I came in and I said to the chap, has it been refueled? Yeah, it's been refueled. But as it's winter, you need to pressurize the tank with nitrogen. So I got it pressurized. And my initial thought was I was going to tether it on the airfield and I'd just bob up and down on the spot.
Good plan.
And, you know, I did this for about 10 minutes and I got the feel of the burner and I got it to the point where I could come down and not touch the floor. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to just let it go. And there was anabatic and katabatic winds in this valley. So for anyone who's not meteorologically of a background, it means that in the valley, if the sun's shining on one side, the winds are rising that side of the valley, and on the other side in the shade, the cool air is coming down. So it creates a box wind syndrome. So I thought I'll just fly across this airfield. I'll go up to about 1,500 feet. I'll come back over the airfield, and I'll descend back down and come back over onto the airfield site. Well, unknown to me, I went out across the airfield. I went up to 1,500 feet. As I'm coming back towards the airfield, I cross some high-tension power lines, bearing in mind the whole environment is snow-lined, and I'm in between these power lines and a housing estate, and then suddenly the burner noise changes, and my sixth sense said to me, this is not right. You're in the poo here, mate. So I started a descent out of 1,500 feet, and at 400 foot, I put the main blast valve on, and I could only tell you it sounded woolly to me.
Oh, that's not
so cool. Eventually, at about 100 foot, I put on the quiet burner as well, the whisper burner, and at about 100 foot, it suddenly ran out of gas. Oh. What I didn't realize was this tank hadn't been refueled, and only 20 minutes into my flight, I was suddenly in this predicament where I'd run out of fuel for this flight. So luckily for me, fortuitously, on the way down, it kissed a fir tree that was snow-lined. That cushioned my descent. I landed next to a log stack that was covered in snow, and basically the balloon was all on top of me. And, you know, people were going, Jesus, what's happened here? Is he all right? Is he all right? When I got out, I just kicked myself that I'd not followed the golden rule of checking that the thing was full of gas myself before going to fly it.
A lucky outcome and a good lesson at the same time.
It was a very, very fortuitous lesson learnt. And, you know, a lot of people said to me, don't say anything to anybody or anything like that. I just thought, you know, I've got to write up my experiences so that somebody else doesn't get caught out the same way. And you know what? It didn't put me off. It actually enthused me more because it sown the seed and I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to have one of these things.
So when you fly a hopper, mate, like you have a couple, I've got one, you know, we've talked about this stuff before, but when you fly a hopper, you know, a lot of people, when they see you hanging there, they think you must be insane. You know, you've got a flame above your head, you've got a gas cylinder, which they see as a bomb strapped to your back. But for me, yeah. I actually feel more secure flying my hopper than in a regular basket. What about you?
I've always felt at ease with it. The only thing I'd say was on my first hopper bottom end I bought off Lindstrand in 2005, I've always flown a hopper where I know that the seat and burner unit is of a quality that I'm comfortable with. I've never flown something that's really second-hand, has had a lot of use, with questionable quality. So knowing that I have good engineering under me and behind me and above me, I never worried about that. I always strapped myself in and just thought, this is a blast, because there aren't that many people would get the experience, and I really digged it. You know, I thought it was good.
Oh, I think it's amazing. It's one of my favourite things in the world to do. So if we go back to the, we sort of bring this back around, I guess, now to you really driving the community for cloud hoppers. Obviously, you've got the passion for them, which is really clearly coming through. You've gone and set up, before you had your first flight, so in 2004, you set up the Yahoo groups. That was one component of it, and you decided to do the newsletter as well. My immediate question, having done a few newsletters, is what the hell were you thinking? Because you obviously didn't realise how much work it would be and how hard it is to get people to contribute.
It is one of these things, mate, where it's famine or feast. You either get content shoved on you by a lot of people, or you have to create it yourself. You have to go to the manufacturers and say to them, well, what are you doing? You know, what are you developing? How's it progressing? Because you could see, I was in an environment where material change was regular. Formula One composites could change year on year. Now, progression in ballooning is slower, but there's still progression. You can see development coming along. You could see things like when Cameron's in Bristol here changed from a Viva to a concept envelope, and you know the reasons behind why they did it. So I was always looking for the change, and I was always trying to project an environment where I was being positive about the sport, and I knew there was enthusiasm for it. I just wanted to try and direct people to a point where they could see a way of getting involved.
But you also didn't just have the newsletter. You also decided at the same time to move away from the Yahoo groups and set up the cloudhoppers.org website as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, for my sins. I knew nothing about websites. I knew nothing about web building. I still probably don't know anything about web building. But one of the guys who crewed for me on my regular balloon was an ace at websites. So, you know, we started this Cloudhoppers balloon website, cloudhoppers.org, and I thought it would be complementary to John Ninemeyer's one in the States, but it would just have a European slant on it, and I could say to people what's going on, where it's going on, what the developments are, because, you know, we had three big manufacturers in Europe, in Ultramagic, in Lindstrands, and in Cameron, who were providing these things. So it was kind of the epicenter of hopping. And I just thought, you know, it's another way of projecting it. And little was I to know that that would eventually lead to Facebook and a Facebook page with over 1,200 people on it worldwide. But it was just gathering enthusiasm. And I'm not really a person who likes to sit in front of the TV and watch Neighbours or something like that. So of an evening, I'd sit with my computer and I'd write these articles out about where I'd been, and I'd try and describe to people the experience, the ambience, and the sensory perception you get. And, you know, when you've got a morning flight and the sun is coming through the ripstop nylon and it's shimmering, and you've got a low-lying mist on the field you're flying out of, those are the days that you have to pinch yourself and remember you're doing it. Because when you're in the middle of a really wet, windy, grotty winter's evening and you're wondering why the hell do you do it, those are the memories you reflect back on to say, yeah, that's why I do it.
You're absolutely right. You're making me a bit misty-eyed talking about all the perfect flying conditions. I'm missing it. So it's 12 years really now since you really started the newsletter. And this month, in a huge achievement that I'm completely blown away by, it's 100 episodes of the newsletter. That's extraordinary.
I know. I can't believe
it. You must be so proud.
I never thought we'd get to 100. Proud? I'm not really somebody who... I don't have an ego. I don't have anything to pacify. I'm delighted we've reached a stage. I was more delighted when we got our first subscribers in Australia, because then I knew we were on every continent of the world. You know, I had these two milestones in my mind. I'd like the thousandth person to sign up to Cloud Hoppers page on Facebook, and I'd like to get to 100 newsletters, and I never thought either would happen. And then below me, the two coincided within 2 months.
It's like fate. It's the gods telling you you're doing the right thing, Steve.
Well, I don't know, you know. I mean, you know, I'm very fortunate to know a lot of people through my connections. You know, you just meet like-minded people. Like, I'll give you an example. I know the Australian balloon manufacturer, Sean Kavanagh, very well. You know, I speak to him regularly. He's got a passion for hoppers. He's producing a prototype one at the moment. You know, for all the Antipodean people who've never had a go in hoppers, there's going to be your local supplier, and that's the guy you'd go to if you don't home manufacture yourself, to get involved in something that is, as you know yourself, it's just unique.
It's fantastically spectacular, is what I tell people. And I just tell them that because they don't have the chance to do it themselves, so they have to believe whatever I say.
No, I mean, the thing with it is, it's very selfish. It's very self-indulgent. And, you know, I'd love to take a GoPro up with me, but, you know, by the time I get sorted, I'll never think about the camera because I'm so wrapped about flying. But, you know, if you could bottle the experience and sell it to people, you'd be a millionaire, because it's just unique. And no flight is ever the same. And, you know, if you have the capacity to fly with like-minded people in similar craft, it's just awesome. It's like flying in a festival and you see a special shaped balloon for the first time. You know, you think of the guy's creativity behind it. You think of the pleasure it's giving people. You think of the audience at that event, and then in the cities that you're flying over, and you know, you just can't quantify it.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's a real privilege. It really is, I think, for those of us who can do it. So you're not one to rest on your laurels, though. You don't like sitting around. You've already said that. You like to be busy. So despite the fact you've got 1,200 people on a Facebook page, you're writing newsletters monthly, bi-monthly, whatever it might be, all the rest of the stuff, you just thought, you know what we really need? Let's do a world record. Why not? Why don't you tell us how that came about?
I don't think it was quite as simple as that. I went to this annual hopper event called the One Man Meet, which is based in the UK. And in 2006, I went to a part of the UK in the Midlands called Derbyshire, which has rolling hills, stone-walled fields, and it's a beautiful environment. You know, it's very picture book English countryside with nice stone cottages, sheep in every field. And at that particular event that year, 29 hoppers flew on this Friday afternoon. There were 30 there. The one that didn't fly was me. And the reason I didn't fly was because my crew buddy at the time was stuck on an oil rig off the Brazilian coastline. He couldn't make it back.
That's a pretty good excuse.
And I just thought, Yeah, I let him off. You know, it was okay. You know, he didn't do it again, but I let him off. and I just thought then, this is the most I've ever seen, but it's unofficially a world record. And so I always thought, wouldn't it be great if we could do a world record and I could get people interested in it? And I'd been every 2 years to this Mondialair Balloon Festival in the Lorraine region of France in a area called Metz. And I thought, if we're going to do it, Metz is the place to do it, because it's the second biggest balloon festival in the world. If people are going to ship their balloons over, they can put a hopper in with it. And if there's a likelihood of beating an existing record, that's the place to do it. So I worked on a four-year plan, and I kind of thought, you know, I've got to get a few milestones in place, and I need to be organized, and I need to, if I'm going to talk to people about doing it, I've got to do it in a professional manner. So I'd already spoke to the guy that ran the balloon festival at Metz, a guy called Philippe Palatre, and you know, he had already welcomed hoppers since 2007 as a second balloon for no additional cost. So people are already flying hoppers out there, and I approached them in October 2016, as I said, look, I've got this idea of doing this Hopper World Record flight. Would you be okay with us doing it? And they said, well, you know, yes, we'll look into it. I said, what I want to do is try and get manufacturers involved. So I put proposals to two manufacturers to come on board. And the one I selected in the end was one that turned around to me, Cameron's, and they said, would you be a brand ambassador? And I hadn't even thought about that because they said, you know, you show passion for this style of ballooning. We've seen sales go up since you've been talking about it. You know, if you talk to people about why you do it and why you would pick a certain brand, would you use ours? So I just got them on board for doing this world record flight. And then suddenly I've become a brand ambassador for them. So I talk to people about the product. I don't do any sales or anything like that. But if people want to know, I'll talk to them. So that sort of was the nucleus behind doing the event. And Cameron said, yeah, we'll support you. And then we had a go. And then it was just a case of getting out there and publicizing it and trying to get people interested in attending to do the attempt in July of this year.
And so what was the number you needed to beat? Was it 29, did you say?
We had to beat 29.
And how does it look? How did you go, do you think?
Well, we actually had 50 there, but due to a small cock-up in the organisation, the timing didn't work out so well as we wanted, so we didn't get the number we projected we'd get. We got 34 in the end, which has upped the record.
Yep, fantastic.
We are now in the process of trying to ratify that with Guinness so that it becomes an official world record. And the way you do it with Guinness is you do it by a system of proving your claims with evidence. So, for example, all 34 of those pilots are submitting me, and I still haven't got them all in yet, their landing card with their information of where they flew from, where they landed, who witnessed it, and I also have a copy of their pilot logbook and their balloon logbook with the entries in there, so that we've got circumstantial evidence beyond reasonable doubt that we can prove to Guinness that this thing happened. I know there is footage on the media, I know there's photographs out there, but Guinness need substantiated proof for it to become ratified as an official Guinness World Record.
What were on the actual day that the flight was down to occur, what were the conditions like on that day? Was it a perfect day? Was it, because the conditions out there in Metz could be stunning.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And it was just perfect weather?
Yes. Let me give you a synopsis of the day. We're talking about surface winds on the airfield of about 3 to 5 knots. We're talking about a westerly direction from the airfield in Chambly, which is Metz, which is out towards open countryside, spasmodic villages with their own individual church. We're talking about the ability to fly low level. I think during my flight, the most I saw was 8.6 knots at any stage. I think that was about 1,000 feet. But also, besides the fact that we were doing this Hopper World record, it was a day they had another record on there. They lined up 438 balloons in a straight line, and we were part of that record on the same day as well. So it was a monumental day. And just to cap it all, I had a specifically liveried brand new envelope from Cameron's that I'd not flown before, that I'd kept back for the Hopper World Record flight. So it was my first flight in that particular balloon.
So it was the grand reveal, was it? You pulled it out and said, ta-da, look at this.
Well, I'd got it a month before, and it got special artwork on in deference to the organisers of the balloon event. I said, well, if I can get this liveried Cameron envelope done with a specific banner on, which says the Mondial Air Balloons Solo Record Flight 2017, I'd get it done. It was just a beautiful day. It was one of those typical midsummer, early morning flights where it was nice and light winds. I flew with about 5 hoppers around me, and I flew for an hour and 25 minutes, and I used not even half of my 60-litre tank of fuel, And as I landed, a guy that I knew really well, who was also a hopper flyer, came over to me and shook my hand, and he said, "Congratulations on your first flight, mate, in your new balloon." And it was just peachy.
Did you have a bottle of champagne handy? Didn't fly over the hills into the Champagne region and pop a bottle?
I wish. No, I didn't, actually. We went back to where we were staying and we cracked a few tinnies.
Well, that's okay. At least you learnt a lesson. You need to have the alcohol to celebrate, so that's important.
Definitely. Next time. You know, I mean, you always look to see what you've done. I'm not somebody who dwells on things, but you look to see what could you do next and what could you do that would be interesting to people and what could you do that would fire people's imagination. Like, for example, I've got something I'm working on that may or may not happen. In the UK, we've got two ginormous airship hangars in a place called Cardington near Bedfordshire, and I would like to hold the only world hopper indoor balloon meet.
Sounds like a fantastic idea.
So if you can imagine going to an airship hangar, knowing you're going to fly, but you just fly the length of the airship hangar in your hopper, it would be so popular, you cannot believe it.
You could do it all day, just refuel tanks, swap them in, swap them out, job done, all day flying.
Yeah, you could. And you know, all it takes is imagination, enthusiasm, and a can-do attitude from people who can help you achieve it, you know, which is the main thing in life, isn't it?
It's what everybody needs to have. So, Steve, let me start to wrap this up a bit for us now here, but there's a couple of questions I've still got for you. So,
shoot.
For me, we all have people in the sport, you know, in ballooning, who've influenced us, or they've helped shape us into the people and the pilots we've become. Who are those people for you?
Well, the first guy I ever saw fly a cloud hopper was a chap by the name of Chris Dunkley, who's a renowned UK maintenance guy. He was part of Flying Pictures when they were the world's leading advertisers in ballooning. They were daredevil people. They were the kind of people who would do crazy things, you know. The first hopper I remember seeing publicly in the press was a guy called Colin Prescott, who was in a hopper on the Thames River here in a suit with a bowler hat and flippers on his feet. You know, it's just, it was a wow factor. People like that inspired me. I always appreciated people like when I bought my first ever balloon, my Lindstrand 90, I happened to be up at the factory. I met Per Lindstrand, who was this guy who set world records for this, that, and the other. I'm just an average Joe who works in a factory, nothing special. I'm invited out to dinner with him that evening, you know? People like that just amaze me. You never know in ballooning where you're going to go and who you're going to meet. And, you know, invariably the outcome is always positive and it's always productive and it's always nice people. You know, you see these events starting up in the world. I went to a very early XLTA experimental balloon meet in the States in a place called Amherst, Massachusetts. The difference being in America, they've got freedom to do manufacturing of their own balloons in their own garages. So I came back from that pumped up with home building. Home building is having a renaissance here in Europe. There seems to be a good push for people who can fly these balloons. Over here, we have a category called Annex 2, which is, you know, what could be nicer than building something and flying a craft you've manufactured yourself, which I think you've done yourself, haven't you?
A number of times, mate. You are preaching to the converted. I think it's the most spectacular thing we can do, but that's a conversation for a totally different day. Let's wrap it up there, mate. It's been fantastic talking to you. I'd like to pull you up on one last thing, though, and say, and we've had this conversation a few times, I know you like to think of yourself as an average Joe, but I think the people listening to this podcast will take it on balance and realize that you're not an average Joe. You're absolutely an inspiration to lots of people out there. You're a doer in the sport. You've got on with it and you're contributing. You're actually making a difference in the sport. You're introducing people to it and showing them a whole different aspect to the sport, which I think is absolutely commendable, and it's a credit to you. And I would like to say thank you very much for coming on Arnie Monkey and talking to us about your passion. I'd like to congratulate you on the 100th episode. I'd like to commiserate you on not being able to do this interview in person and have a beer with you. And I look forward to the chance when we get to catch up next. And it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. And thanks very much for joining us.
Adam, you and I both know that to share a passion is the ultimate, because you're just sowing the seed to the next generation. You never know where the next pilot's going to go from or to. If you go to a balloon festival and you see a kid in the audience and the kid is rapt by what you're doing, you don't know. In 5, 10, 15 years' time, that could be the next pilot. You know, what you're doing with Auntie Monkey is brilliant. You're sowing the seed and you're putting it out there, mate. Thank you very much for everything you said. You and I need to get together somewhere and we need to have a social beer and just chew the fat, mate.
Sounds magnificent. Now, we'll put up a link for everybody listening. We'll put up a link to the Cloudhoppers website of Steve so you can have a look at that. That'll be in the podcast notes under episode 4. We'll also put up the 100th episode of the Cloudhoppers newsletter, Steve, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
So people can see what that's all about and they can get involved with it that way. Now, everybody, if you're enjoying the Arnie Monkey podcast, which I'm sure you all are, please remember to subscribe to the podcast and also go and tell your friends about it. Yeah, actually, you really don't have to tell them. You could just sort of like sneak up, grab their phone, something like that. Just subscribe them automatically. Don't tell them. It'll just turn up. Go on. Just go on and do that. That's a great idea. Just do it. Thanks very much for listening.